Okay, folks, you should have your Bibles once again open to the 139th Psalm. We're returning back here now to get the final virtue or the final matter that David extols in this Psalm about prayer, is in light of him being able to function as kind of a preview of coming attractions for what a son will be, and having your heart search to ensure that the doctrine has been written there, that it's up and running well, and it is able to generate this almost personal attendance of the Father over your education. And then he moves on after dealing with that in verses 5 and down through verse 12. Begin there in verse 13, and we're going to take a look at the verses that comprise this final matter. David writes, and there's some pretty famous or familiar passages in this. He says in verse 13, For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them. And after that he's going to just expound on his praise. He says, how precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God, how great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. Well, let's take a look especially from verse 13 down through verse 16 that makes up this final matter of the searching of the heart. When it comes to this last matter of sonship prayer, one of the things that you've got, and if it's when you read down through that and you think about what David is saying there, why do you think David would suddenly shift to talking about being formed in his mother's womb and his substance not hid from thee and God's eyes saw his son? What's he talking about? Why does he shift to talk about that? Good. That's real good. When you first started there, you were like 50% away from the bullseye, and as you kept talking, you kept getting closer to the bullseye, and you were almost right on it when what you were saying. But the only little adjustment you need to make in that is that he's not just simply talking about being a human being. You're right in that he is extolling the marvels of being a human being. But what's the context? What kind of a human being? A believer, a son. Yeah. What's going on here? But I like your thought process because it was leading you right to it. When it comes to this final matter, David is really going to focus upon the way in which God made him. And God made David, and God made you to have your heart written upon and written upon by Him and by His words. That's why David can't contain himself after talking about the way in which God made him. How precious are thy thoughts to me, O God! And he puts with that exclamation point. By the way, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 exclamation points doesn't make it any more. It's just need one. How great is the sum of them? But what I'm after in all of that is that follows on the heels of David talking about the way God made him. And he didn't just make him any old way. And this is one of those goofball ideas that you hear people say. Sometimes you'll even hear homosexuals say, well, this is the way God made me. Look, the idea that God doesn't make mistakes. No, he doesn't make mistakes, but you do. You idiot. And God didn't make your sin nature, your nature of sin. You did that pretty good all on your own. But the thing of it is that God did make you a very particular way, and he made you to have something. The epitome of all that he made you is to have something called this inner man, in which there's this thing, and don't think that I'm getting into areas that I can't. You notice the chart is black. I can't draw it. I can't illustrate it. I don't even know how it's all put together. I know that there's a body. I know there's a soul. I know there's a spirit. And I know the spirit and the soul at times, as the book of Hebrews talks about, needs to have some division to it, although they're not ever broken apart separately. I understand some of that. But my thinking gets real thin on some of these matters, except what God says about it, I believe what he says. And I believe there really is a fleshy table, a book, so to speak, of leaves and pages in it that can be written upon in my heart. And though that's what David's extolling, is that you made me to have a heart, an inner man with a soul and a spirit, and to have my heart written upon, but not just written upon by any old words, but by your words. There's no other words that can be written upon that book. Only your words. And that's why somewhere, someplace, sometime, if it hasn't hit you yet, the most powerful thing known to God, man, or the universe is an expression that I say oftentimes here, but I don't know how deeply it's made its impact yet, is to have the living words of the living God live in you. And that's not just being memorized. They live in you. These words live. They're living words. This isn't like being an expert with Moby Dick, or being an expert with Our Mutual Friend, or some other great novel. This is being an expert with living gods that are designed to be able to live in your heart when they're written upon it. And the truth is, your heart was ever designed to be written upon by the finger of God. That's what it's designed for. And as much as this world comes up with all kinds of books, because the world knows that that's the crux of the matter. That's where great problems arise, and where great money is to be had, right? That people are in inner turmoil. And so there's all kinds of motivational speakers, and the world will throw all kinds of wisdom at you. And, well, we tried it this way back in the 50s and tried it this way in the 60s. Well, now we're trying it this way. And there's always some new thing. Have you read the new author? And he's got his new book. No, I've got a 2,000-year-old book at the newest. The newest books in my book are over 2,000 years old. Have you ever considered that book? But there's all kinds. The world writes books about how to heal your insides. You know, when tragedy starts, all that, and there's some modicum of success with it, or they wouldn't be selling them. And it's like I said, it's that one of those was like that book that came out years back called Chicken Soup for the Soul. All kinds of heart help, you know, information. Now, while none of that does what God has designed to be done in your heart, the thing that even unbelievers recognize is that you are a very complex being, and things that satisfy you bodily. I was watching this. I saw about 1 minute of something that was on last night. I don't even know what it was. There's something about a lottery guy, a guy who had won the lottery, and it's just like winning the lottery is just riddled with disaster. This guy won the lottery. He gave tons of money to his daughter. His daughter took it, went right out, and bought the most highest and expensive amount of drugs that she could buy. Nearly killed herself doing that. He lost his wife. He lost his family. He lost everything. And he sat there bawling on TV. This is a big guy, probably weighs 300 pounds, big old Texas hat, bawling his eyes out, saying that the worst day of my life was when I won the lottery. And he won hundreds of millions of dollars. He said that was the worst day of my life. Just tears rolling. The world knows and has this sense that what satisfies you bodily doesn't necessarily satisfy you internally. Even the unbelievers of the world recognize that, that there's this need for balance and moderation, and even ungodly lost people can recognize that human beings are made up in a very unique way. As much as they try, and a lot of the evolutionists try to equate you with a monkey, they do recognize there's just some difference. And in some cases, some evolutionists pine for the monkey. You know, I know they'd love to be one. And as much as I'd love for them to be one, they're not. But that's the kind of recognition there is, and it's a huge recognition that we as human beings are made in a very unique way. But you understand that as a son, you understand that that uniqueness isn't just some abstract thing in psychology. But you understand that, and you understand that it's not sufficient enough just to take some chicken soup for the soul and have some little band-aids put on the heart and all these kind of things. You recognize that isn't going to accomplish anything, but rather your inner man needs to it was made to perfectly mate. And that's the word I really want to stress. It's designed to mate, to match up with, to perfectly fit the very words of God. It's like the word of God is this plug, and your heart has a socket that perfectly fits that plug, and nothing else is going to fit in there. That's the way God designed your inner man, and that's pitiful in explaining it, but that's the degree to which it fits. It fits perfectly. It's designed to mate. And those things, when that happens, real change is going to occur in you that is designed to change you into a creature that's just like God Himself. And by the way, because God's Word is designed to be written on your heart, that allows for what I've brought up in the past, it allows for reproof. It allows for rebuke. It allows for real correction and adulthood-style sonship discipline to take place. God's discipline is adult-style. It's not, well, I'm going to take you behind the shed and beat you and skin you within an inch of your life. It's not anything like that. But it is there. It is a component. It's built into the curriculum, though. But the fact that God can write His Word upon your heart, and that can become a permanent sensitive matter on your heart, allows for the benefit of rebuke and reproof and correction to take place. Yeah, try correcting somebody you work with who just has no idea, really, the way you want something done. It's crazy because they'll go right to the job, they'll do it the way you told them to do it one time, and then they'll go to doing it another way. And you find out, it gets so frustrating if you've ever been an employee or an employer, because you find out you just have to hover over them. I just have to watch everything they do. I keep telling them and I keep telling them, but they just, if I walk away, they'll just start doing it somewhat. I think we've all experienced at least being on one end or the other of that kind of thing in some job that we had, whether it was mowing a lawn or whether it was whatever you're doing now. But one of the problems that a good employer will see is there's nothing in that guy's heart that I can appeal to. I got to get it across to him how critical and important this is. I used to work over here with Rob and with Bob, and heavens, if I was cutting out a particular a folder on that big cutter over there, and I was even a 16th of an inch off in cocking that to one side, so when the folds came together, the back side was down just a little bit from the top side. If I was just off a little bit, there could be a multi-$1,000 job rejected. And worse than that would be the name of that good plant and good business, and the name of that good businessman could fall under disrepute because of me, because I didn't pay attention to 1/16th of an inch. and check my work. And I at first, it was hard until I realized how important it was and how critical it was and how it meant something to the success or failure of that business. And then I got it. It's like, ding, a light went on. I got to make sure of this every time. Well, that's a poor analogy because it's personal. But what I'm after is that with us and with our Father building us the way He's built us, making us so that our heart can be written upon, it allows for God's reproof and rebuke and correction and chastisement to not only be meaningful, listen, but at the end of it, to be joyful. If something has truly been written upon your heart, and God can come along and not by Him verbally telling you, but because in this assessment that you're doing in your sonship prayer with Him, you recognize this didn't work the way I was taught, this failed, I had some problems with this today, and then you go back to the curriculum and you realize, well, it's right there, I've got it right there in black and white, and then you realize that the curriculum can correct that, and that, well, it just sits there and reproves me. Well, I didn't rejoice with them and weep with them. I didn't do that. I didn't bless and curse not. I cursed them back. Well, now I'm being corrected, but there's something there. And when it's all said and done, you and I have experienced this where we've kicked ourselves out and we said, well, that didn't work well and that didn't go. But the joy of that is that we can come back to that curriculum because it's been written there and make the correction and have the reproof and have the rebuke and walk away with joy and saying, this is so great that the world didn't come to an end. Things aren't over. My Father isn't kicking me out of the relationship. He's not doing any of those things. He's built the curriculum with a built-in reproof correction to it. And so I gain that correction through that reproof and rebuke. And it's a joyful thing because the reproof and the rebuke has something written on your heart that's already there that matches up with it. And that makes it so that it's got something to appeal to. When was the last time you were chewed out by your boss and ended up with it being a delightful process? It was a delight. And you rejoiced because of it. And that's, by the way, why later on in the Proverbs it'll talk about the waste of time it is to rebuke a fool and reprove a fool. Why? Because there's nothing, it's not going to work. There's nothing in his heart for the reproof to match up with. Your Father doesn't call you names. He provides the kind of reproof an adult would need to be able to say, now look, did this work? No. All right, why? You go back to the way I think. Did you get that godly thinking down? Well, maybe there's your problem. And you said, well, I got that, but there was some reluctance in making full use of it in my conduct and behavior. Well, there's your problem. So now review something there and get it going again. But it's when it's all said and done, it's the joy and the rejoicing of saying, man, this thing really works. Even when I fail, it has a system whereby it will correct me, right me, get me back going again, and life is going to provide the opportunity for me to put it right to use. This takes discipline into a field that you've never experienced before. Where when you walk away from it all, man, you are full of joy and delight. Well, this third matter is going to extol some of David's own delight about his sonship prayer life, and he's going to do it in two particular issues. Look there in verse 13, he expresses these two issues here, and they're divided by that very powerful, second most powerful pause in our English language. You have a colon in verse 13. So the first issue is, for thou hast possessed my reins. And he's going to extol that. We need to explore that and understand a little bit about that. And then he's going to talk about the second issue. When it comes to the way you made me, you have possessed my reins. And the second issue is, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. And then he's going to talk about that second issue. He's going to extol and elaborate upon in verse 14, verse 15, and verse 16. So he makes the first statement that's designed to have some impact. Thou hast possessed my reins. Then he makes the second statement. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. And he's going to take three verses to elaborate upon that. So that's kind of the breakdown of what's going to be going on here. But let's just, for the remaining time we have, at least introduce this a little bit. Look at that first issue. And we're going to come back to this, but I want to bring one thing out here right away. He says, for thou hast possessed my reins. Now, we're going to talk about reins a little bit later on, but possessing your reins is actually an expression of the perception David has and the perception you are to have, especially when it comes to this last thing that sonship prayer settles out. It's an expression of perceiving the ultimate outworking of the sonship doctrine, of the sonship curriculum. The ultimate outworking of it is suddenly something that I possessed myself is now in the possession of my Father. Something big about me, something huge about me, is now no longer possessed by me, but possessed by Him. I'm possessed. There's a real good sense of that, by the way. I'm possessed. Love has a lot to do with that. I became possessed when somebody told me, you know that little girl in the band that sits first chair clarinet? She likes you. Man, that flipped a switch in me. She likes you. First time in my life. I was always the one going after it. I never went after her at all. It's just like the Bible. God creates Eve and she came to me. And then I was possessed. Been possessed for ever since. So there's a good way to be possessed, I guess. Talking myself into it anyway. What does it mean, though? What does it mean when it said to possess something? You know what that means. What does it mean to possess something? That's possessed my reins. If you possess something, what do you have? You've got hold on it. When you've taken it, it's now yours. You've taken it to be your own. And that's a good synonym for taking possession of something. Ownership. You own it. And that's what David is almost coming like. He's saying, you own my reins. You possess my reins. You take ownership. It now belongs to you. And in this context, your reins now belong to your Father. He has possession or ownership of what is called your reins. And this is what each and every sonship doctrine of this curriculum, all that you have now gone through experience-wise in two major sonship decision-making skills with nine components to it, every one of those components is designed ultimately to produce this: your Father possessing your reins. It's ultimately designed so that when that doctrine effectually does its job and it gets properly written upon your heart, and now it is a part of you is now, even though it's not the totality of you or your heart, but a part of your heart now perfectly matches with your Father's. When it comes to godly selfless love and thinking as a there's a part of that that now perfectly matches your Father. When it comes to loving kindness, tenderheartedness, meekness, when it comes to the issues of basic wisdom and basic justice, there's parts of your heart now that are matching your Father's. I don't know if you've thought about how great that is, but I can tell you this for some of you, it will dispel any discouragement you have in your life with other believers who just don't get it. There's nothing quite more glorious or almost mind-blowing. It's like that little commercial where the girl says something to the guy and he goes, that just blows you away to say that something in me matches perfectly with the Heavenly Father. But that's what how that doctrine is designed to operate. A part of you perfectly matches him. Real change has taken place. When that occurs, piece by piece, and that's how it's going to happen. It's not just going to be this kind of global, boom, now you're like God. But it's going to be piece by piece by piece that a part of you now belongs to him. It's almost as if it's now his possession. And therefore, he does take possession of it. It's just incredible. We'll come back to that. But this second issue, just to get it on the table as to what's going on here, David extols the second issue, "Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb." And when he's going to talk about the other issues that surround that concept, that "Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb," again, both of these issues, his reigns and what he was in his, all are speaking to that issue of how God made him. And the sonship doctrine is designed to end up with this searching of your heart. And when that's done, the perception is supposed to be that you recognize and that, listen, that you are deeply and you are suitably impressed with the fact that what you just went through you've got experience now with it. What you just went through in having your heart written upon with that doctrine is exactly what you were made to be involved in even before you were born. That's what God's design was. God's design was for you to be involved in this with him even before you were born. That was his design. I know a lot of people read this and they talk about, well, God created me and designed me, and before he thought about me before I was ever born, he knew about me before I was born, and blah, 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 blah. And that's true. But there's a disconnect with that, because their thoughts will trail off, because they'll just say, well, I was born to be with him and live with him forever, and so Jesus came and died for me. That's good as far as it goes, but that's not what David is saying here. He's going way beyond that. He's going to the issue of this writing of your words on my heart is exactly what you designed me for before I was ever born. When God designed you for what you would be as a man, for what you would be as a woman, this is what he designed you for. And David's extolling an appreciation for each and every time you come along and you are conformed, 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 and we could just check them on down through the line. Each and every time you are conformed to the image of the Son of God from glory to glory, you're to appreciate an ever-increasing capacity for the fact that what just took place is the very reason I'm alive on this earth. That's why I'm here. Everything else misses the bullseye. That hit the bullseye. That's the reason you were made in the first place. And folks, there's real joy that comes from that, and one of the greatest byproducts of it all, even in the face of having to stand a lonely outpost in this world, one of the greatest byproducts you'll ever have from that is true, genuine, godly contentment and satisfaction. My heart is satisfied. And there's nothing that can be on a lifelong journey of dead ends like the human heart. And what I'm saying is joy comes from that. Joy to work with God in all that God is doing today. And your joy and your passion for working together with your Father should be ever increasing with every increment of this, and go beyond any passion you have for any other job and any other career that you've got. This is where your real labor passion lies. And each time there's a step made in the progress of the curriculum for your sonship education, and you know that that success has taken place, you know that that has been made, you know that you successfully moved through another component or another form of doctrine, It's designed to impact you and to strike you with the reality that you see in a greater and greater way. Man, this is what I was ever made for. I know that thought occurred to me when I first understood even what adoption was. Well, this is why I was created. And it's exponentially better than that now that we're in the curriculum. I see that's how I was designed to function. I wasn't designed to be ever worried and wringing my hands about what my government is doing. No, I was designed to be able to utilize justice and understand the power that God created so that with joy I can pay tribute, render tribute, and fear, custom and fear to, and honor to whom it is due. That the powers that be are designed by God that check man's violence, and they're going to do a bunch of wicked, evil, horrible, God-awful things that government's going to do. But they're all going to be maintaining the one issue that God designed for the powers to be. And there's, I'm just using that as an example to say, when that becomes a living reality to you, and you can take all of the worry and the fear, and I got to listen to Rush 3 hours a day, and all this kind of crap that is being shoveled on you, and in the guise of good, godly behavior, you can take all that stuff and jettison it. I don't need them at all. In fact, I know things about government Rush Limbaugh will never know. Or Sean Hannity, or O'Reilly, or any of the other pundits that are out there. None of them know this stuff. They don't act as a son would act. They don't talk like a son would talk, an educated, intelligent son. And I'm not trying to say that to beat these guys down or to step on your toes. I'm saying this to say there's real joy in understanding that this is how God made me to be, so that when my heart has that written upon it, I can handle the downfall of this country. I can handle the communization of this country perfectly fine and function as a son in it and use it to my advantage and be more than a conqueror in it. And again, I'm not trying to get off on that subject. I'm trying to show you how what we've learned in the curriculum can produce godly contentment, satisfaction, and joy because it satisfies the heart. This is what I was made for. And so David says here, that, in fact, something that I have to say to be just fully honest about it, and hopefully not to get ahead of ourselves here, but since we're starting to wane on time a little bit, he says something here. I have to honestly say I really don't have the capacity to fully understand and fully appreciate this at the point I'm at in my own sonship education to the degree I want to be able to appreciate it. But I do believe that as we grow in that sonship capacity, that we will gain the capacity to appreciate it. And again, not to get ahead of ourselves, but I love what verse 16 says, to the degree I understand it. He says, "Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book," that's not the Bible, folks, "in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them." David says, before I was ever born. Now think of this for a moment. This goes for you too. Before you were ever born, David says, when I was just conceived in the womb, before my body was, why he uses the word yet being unperfect. You ever see pictures of a little embryo baby before the arms get developed, the hands kind of look like little nubs on the fingers, and then the fingers get developed? David said, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about when my, before my body was perfected and all my members, and you know the word members now in a body analogy, coming back out of Romans chapter 6 there and yielding the members, the body, your body parts, your arms and legs and everything, as either members of righteousness unto God or unrighteousness to your own carnal fleshly desire. He says, before I was born, when I was just conceived, my body was all unperfect. My members weren't even fully formed. But yet he says, in thy book, all my members were written. David says that before he was born, God had a book. That's how God does things. I love this about my father. He has no computers. He doesn't have computers. He has books. I fully believe that and fully expect to see that when it comes to the book of life and the books of works, that they will be literal books, that it's not going to be some angel sitting there at a gigantic cray computer. They'll consult the book. It has been written. Well, God has written a lot of books. The fallacy is that God only wrote the Bible. God wrote a lot of books, and he knows how to write books. One of the reasons oftentimes somebody will ask me, are you going to write a book on Romans? No. Why? One reason, biggest reason of all, I don't know how to write a book. It takes understanding and skill of what a book is, how to write it. I don't know how to write a book, so I'm not going to write a book. God knows how to write books. And he's written lots of them. This is a book. There's several of the books that God has written that are not the Bible, but they're mentioned in the Bible. One of the most intriguing books is called The Book of the Wars of the Lord. The Book of the Wars of the Lord is a book that holds all of God's battle plans for his day of wrath out here. It's called The Book of the Wars of the Lord. And all the flight path that Christ takes when he comes back and all the bombardment, all of that battle and everything, those things are all written in that. There's another book, though, here that he calls the Book of My Members. And God has written a book that identifies all your body parts. Whether you've had them cut off or you've had them, and I've had some cut out. In God's book, he has the original size of my colon. Right now it's 9 inches shorter. He has, and it's almost as if you take a person who's been vaporized on the battlefield. Well, how are we going to reconstruct him? God has a book. It's all written there. And there was this book that God has identified all of David's members in, all of his parts. And David is, what he's doing is, when he's saying that, yet being unperfect, in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. He's extolling his appreciation for the fact that he is starting to, listen, the reason he brings this up is because in your book, you wrote about my hands, my fingers, my legs and my feet, my eyes and my ears and my mouth. You wrote about my members. And now, what he's extolling is, for the very first time, when my heart gets your word written there, and then my hands and my feet and my eyes and my mouth begin to do the living words of the living God, and they begin to live in me, David is appreciating the fact that he's now starting to use the members God wrote in his book exactly the way God intended for them to be used. When he wrote them in his book, he intended that they were supposed to be used just that way. To say just, I rejoice when I hear thy lips. My lips are written in that book. And when thy lips speak right things. And David is talking about, this is so fantastic. And this is something that's a part of his prayer life. Wouldn't you have loved to have just been a fly on the wall? Or been able to peek at David when he was praying to God? What must have that been like? It must have been like a party going on. Like this guy is having the best time of his life. And all he's doing is praying. He wasn't down prostrate on the floor with his hands out and all this kind of thing. But he's extolling the fact that this is something that my members were designed to do, and when I'm doing that, that's what they were designed for. And I'd like to say more and more about that subject, but don't ask me about it, because that's about all I can say about that. I don't understand that book of members as well as, but I do know that much. But when it came to David's education, as he grew in his education and appreciated that more and more, and his appreciation grew more and more for the fact that this is what I was made to be doing in the first place. Well, let's at least get a little bit of this morning, so we can get along just a little bit in the time we have left. Let's go back to that first issue there in verse 13. And we'll put some more definition to this in time, but for today's sake, so we can have something to work on in preview of next time. When he says, "For thou hast possessed," we talk about this possession, taking ownership of my reins. What are your reins? The way it's used here in the Bible. What are your reins? That's a word we don't use a lot in this kind of way. Anybody got any idea? Your sentiments? Your emotions? Actually, and that's right, the word reins, this R-E-I-N-S, literally, and you'll find this both in Hebrew and in Greek, the literal word reins, or reins, means kidneys. Now, why would that be? Why the kidneys? Thou hast possessed my kidneys. Huh? No. Emotion. Why do you say that? What does emotion come? Why would somebody conclude that emotion, if you're going to put a body part on it, would come from your kidneys? Not because it feels so good to go to the bathroom. What sits on top of that little bean-shaped kidney? Your adrenal gland. And your adrenaline glands is what gives you that charge of excitement, that charge of energy, and where your body starts to emote and all those kinds of things. So it's not illogical that the kidneys is the radical root for the reins. But it's used as that physical analogy for what you've all been expressing there, for your emotions. And that's what you've got when you've got, "Thou hast possessed my reins." It's where you look at as the seat of your feelings, your affections, all of those kinds of things we've been talking about. The reins and the heart are closely related. And there's places in God's Word where He will talk about both of them together, that God is the one who deals with the reins and the heart, and you'll find them both in the same sentence. So they're not just interchanging words for the same thing, but they are very closely linked together. The seat of feelings and the reins, the heart, the reins and the heart being closely linked together in the Bible. Therefore, it's the reins is the part of your inner man linked with the heart that is the seat of your passions, your affections, your feelings. And one of the things I like to always remember about reins, it's the seat of your desires. It's where your passion is, where your desire is, your feelings. And what's important to that expression, "Thou hast possessed my reins," God now has that in His possession, is that this indicates that part of your inner man, the part where your passions and your desires and your affections reside, are now in the hands of your Father. Also, what's another way in which we use the word reins today? That's totally, it's not really, you don't think of it though as connected with this, the seat of emotions or feelings or passions or desires. What? You guide a horse with reins. Right. And that's why the word reins is used there. Because the reins is a place where, since desire occurs, you can guide from there. Guidance can take place. And it's a term that's used oftentimes to describe a mechanical tool to control a horse or other animal. And so therefore, reins can be used to describe a means of restraint or check or control or guidance. Reins can be used to describe a means of restraint, check, control, or guidance. And interestingly enough, when it comes to lost people of this world, how are they mostly guided? Yeah, I guess you could say that about most Christians too. But when it comes especially to the lost people of this world, they're largely guided by their passions. Even you'll hear it sometimes when somebody commits murder, something so horrible as murder, that it was a murder of passion. A passion just took over. And you oftentimes find that they're largely guided by their feelings and their emotions. But when David says, in the context of the 139th Psalm, not trying to lift this out of the context and then the entirety of that psalm, "For thou hast possessed my reins," he's saying that the sonship doctrine that he's got now in his heart has obtained a particular victory in his heart, so that you, God, you now possess my reins. It has been that successful. The success of the sonship curriculum has taken the reins. If you think about sitting in that horse-drawn carriage, and it has taken the reins from the hands of me and put them into the hands of my Father and say, "There, you possess them." And folks, where your desires are located and your passion is located, if that can be turned by someone else, he can guide you. He has a controlling mechanism. Where do you think this is all going and derived from? That small case S. P-I-R-I-T. This is describing what Paul will later on say, you know all that stuff we've been talking about? What that stuff is having the Spirit which is of God. He's got the reins now of your passion and your desires, your enthusiasm, your feelings, your sentiments. And so that doctrine has so effectually worked to the point of God now taking possession of what guides you and controls you, what constrains you. And your Father, your own passions don't guide you like that anymore. It's your Father's passions. It matches His Spirit. It's that that are the reins that He now has in His possession. It's the point where your own passions don't, your Father's passion, your Father's Spirit now guides you. It's now, yours is in His hands. And this is the point where you really are not what the end of the instruction of wisdom says. You are not wise in your own conceits. You're not someone who can be talked about as God possessing their reins cannot come along saying, "Well, you know, in this particular situation, I just can't imagine that'll work. So I imagine what I will say will work." Right. You're such a genius. I just can't imagine. More destruction has happened to a human heart leading with those words than anything else. "I just can't imagine." It's kind of like in the physical world. There was a guy, I heard a surgeon once, or an ER, he was an emergency doctor who was out in Arizona, and where they treated the highest amount of snake bites of anywhere else in the country. And he said, "Do you know what were the last words of this guy, of most of the guys that come in with snake bites? Watch this." Usually there was a girl involved, and his last words were, "Watch this." He was going to impress her. More physical damage has happened leading with those words, "Watch this." Well, it's kind of like in the inner man. More damage in the inner man has taken place, preceded by the words, "I just can't imagine." That's being wise in your own conceits. This is the opposite of that. This is where you realize that you aren't going to be wise in your own conceits, and that your Father now possesses your reins. You're no longer going to be a slave to your passions, your desires, your inclinations. And this, by the way, and we need to wrap this up, so I'm going to end with this, but this is so critical to your sonship education, because the issue of not just getting doctrine in your heart, right? Remember how we often said when we started this, something that would have been unthinkable for us 15 years ago, is that doctrine can only do so much. I'd have never said that under my old systematic ways. It was always doctrine is the end all of everything. But doctrine, your Father can only do so much with the doctrine, because there's more than just that. There's His sentiments, His feelings, His whole heart is involved in getting installed into your heart. And so you realize that you're no longer a slave to those passions you once had, but because the issue is one of not just getting doctrine in that heart, but getting your Father's whole heart installed in yours, the truth is, folks, this becomes, this little expression, "Thou hast possessed my reins," becomes one of the final proofs. In fact, it is the final proof that the doctrine really has been written on your heart. Because your desire is to go there. Your desire is to do that. Your desire is to say that. It doesn't even occur to you anymore to say, think, or do what you imagine should be done. But the recognition is there that this is the final proof of it. The final proof is that when it comes to my desire, my passion, my inclination, all of these kinds of things, when it comes to my job, when it comes to my family, when it comes to my relationship with husband, wife, son or daughter, whatever is going to be, mother, father, whatever it is, that now is in the hands of my Father. My reins are in His hands. And therefore, it's the final proof that the doctrine has been written there on your heart. It has achieved permanent, sensitive attainment. It has achieved a permanent, sensitive reality in your heart. And if it truly has functioned properly, you not only know it, you know that it's there, you understand the doctrine, you appreciate the doctrine, you respond positively to it, properly to it, made full use of it, and it was just as if you, Father, were right there with me all the time. But beyond that, the real success of that doctrine is found in one last issue, which is the decision to implement that doctrine, the decision to exercise godliness, was made I want to stop right there, and I want you to think about it. Instead of just telling you what it is, what would be the last full proof that the Father would want to see that the doctrine is really there? Because there's one last step to it. And I almost blurted it out, but I don't think I'm going to. I'm going to leave you with this cliffhanger until Wednesday. Think about, between now and then, your Father's there, He's teaching you and He's instructing you. And you know this, but I want you to bring it back to your mind. It's something we've talked about at times when we went through the sonship establishment portion of Romans 8, of what it means to be our Father's son. In the final analysis, when something has become of such permanent nature in your heart, like that, and it can be extolled by David as, "Thou hast possessed my reins." And it settles out this last step, this last matter, where the Father would look and say, he's got this. He's got this to the same degree I've got it. There's one last step to this. And see if you can, again, when it comes to the decision to implement the doctrine and exercise the godliness, to help you out, to give you some direction where we're going, what would it be that your Father's looking for between you and Him, decision-wise? Now, I'm talking about to the this is when you've got it perfectly down. What is going to satisfy Him that between you and Him, when it comes to you implementing and putting godliness into effect, that He would say, there He is, He's got it. You understand the question? You don't understand the question. What would be the thing that your Heavenly Father would look at in you to determine that you've got it when it comes to you talking to Him about it? When it comes to you and Him even discussing the matter, what would He look at to say, there's no doubt in my mind that they've got this? Because this takes it to the final step, and I'll tell you this, it goes beyond this issue of discussing it with Him. It's actually an issue that, well, maybe I shouldn't even leave it at that. Now you're making me think I'm just confusing you. Does anybody have an idea? Well, just in your mind. Yeah. But there's something that we talked about where it settles the matter between you and especially on your Father's side that you've got this. And it's, think of it in business. When you're doing your Father's work, and you're going to have to do some work for that day, and you're going to have to implement this doctrine, not this doctrine, but this doctrine, not that doctrine, that doctrine. And this is going to sound funny at first if you haven't heard of this, but I'm not going to leave you with just hanging, I guess. I changed my mind. And this sounds strange to say it this way, but there's something your Father will look for that, again, and it's the last issue of it all, when it comes to making a decision to implement the doctrine, to know that you know you've got it and He knows you've got it, and you're going to exercise godliness in this way in your day, one of the last things He's looking for. It goes beyond that. It's a step beyond that. And it's really exemplified by Him possessing your reins. I'm trying to get you to think of something that I know, but it's probably, I'm not saying it well enough to bring it to your attention. When the Father adopted His Son, why did He adopt Him? To labor with Him in His business. When His Son is fully educated, what does that education hold out for the Son to be able to do? To what? Work and labor. Right. In the Father's business, right? Okay, but let's stay on this labor issue. Remember how I said that without something in the heart, it's as if the boss has to stand over his employer all the time? What is one of the joys and one of the things that Sonship Education holds out for you to be able to do? Yeah. What do you mean by that? Right. Yeah, you're moving now into the bullseye. This is going to work in such a way that the last thing your father wants to see is that you're going to implement that doctrine unto godliness without ever having to pray about it at all. You don't ever have to even discuss it with him. The discussion is done. Because it's now you, your nature. We use an expression, and we use it flippantly, but it really applies here and it has some great meaning when something becomes second nature. There should be a time, ladies and gentlemen, when you no longer have to discuss with your father these matters. You'll be discussing more advanced matters with him. But these things are going to become so well written on your heart that the last thing the father looks for is that he now has control of the reins and you no longer even have to confer with him or settle out a matter. It's just second nature. The doctrine has become so... If you look at that issue of second nature, it means that something is so instilled in you that it becomes innate. It's so deeply ingrained in you that it appears, that's, by the way, a very important word, it appears to be automatic. It's not automatic, but it appears. That you don't go on autopilot. You know why? Because you still have a nature of sin. And you can still walk away from it. And you can still get allured by something, depending on where you are in this, by the course of this world, by the strange woman, all those things and possibilities are there. But when you are operating as a son, it appears like you're operating automatically. That's second nature. And you'll come to a point where you're not going to have to pray about how you're going to give with simplicity in the local assembly. It will be as if you're the Father himself doing it. The Father doesn't consult with his pray to himself. He doesn't have to. He knows what to do, he knows how to do it, and he knows how to do it perfectly, and he does it perfectly. And that's one of the magnificent aspects of this, is where you move past that line where you no longer have to pray about these things or talk to your Father about them to settle them out. But you've moved on to talking about far more advanced things. These things are things that you and him are perfectly in sync with, perfectly attuned to. And you're doing this all the time. And the decisions you make, your father looks at you and said, you go ahead and make them. You can make them on your own. You can make them independently of me. Now, that's not to say you're ever independent of your father in any real way at all. But it's as if you could run his business and he could say, I'm going on vacation. I'm going to go away and start another business. Because you can run mine perfectly as if I was with you, as if I was there myself. You'll treat my customers exactly the way I'd treat them. You'd say to my customers just what I would say. Remember when we talked about that when we started Sonship? What it means for the father to put that shingle out and say, father and son in business together. And that's one of the grandeurs of sonship prayer when it leads to that point where this has gotten so permanently written on my heart that I no longer have to, and then say I won't, but to make the decision, I don't have to confer with my father at all. I know exactly what to do. And some of you may already be there with some of this doctrine right now. That's the way it's designed to have successes and meet some goals and have some victory in your inner man, so that your father begins taking possession of those reins as if he was guiding you with those reins himself. Well, so what I thought I'd do, by way of giving you a cliffhanger, I just blew it all, so there you go. And we'll discuss this more as we tidy up these things, but this is a fascinating issue that David sets forth here. But we'll stop it right there, and we'll pick this up. And that's only the way a natural father would be. It's one thing to have a son talk to him about the very beginnings of how to turn the machines on in the business, but after he's been in the business with you for 10 years, you're not going to discuss how to turn the lights on and set the emergency system. That he already knows how to do. We're going to talk about deeper things. And that's the way this is supposed to be ever growing. Well, I need to shut up. So let's stop and get out of here before the chicken burns. With our heads bowed, Heavenly